supporting on this bill, Senate Bill 72. I'm not going to take any further time today on it, but I do think that the legislature, you know, if you want to wait for a scandal to occur, that's fine, but I do think that the responsible thing to do is to ensure that we have got the accountability for this large sum, federal dollars, that is flowing to the state legislature and that is being expended in the state and for which we have a liability. So we'll just set this bill aside for now. I'd like to have Marilyn go through the remainders of those bills.
Do you want me to go through the whole bill, then in terms of the changes made, or do you want just one by one?
Well, starting here.
Okay.
The last time when we worked on these bills, we were not able to get staff work that was done on that. And I know that although the committee may not support them, I want them to understand what these bills are.
In the front of your overview files is a packet of bills that include the amendments made in the rest of the debt for package. Senate Bill 268 requires the ethics requirement, and that has not changed. There have been no amendments to that bill. Senate Bill 269, a section that was formerly in 270 was amended and brought into Section 269, and it is requiring that the state and local agencies with responsibility for administering the program shall expend not less than 15% of the monies available to a service delivery area for support services. What in effect this will do is reduce the fiscal impact statement that was on the original Bill 269 as it was. 270 was amended to create requirements of a legislative overview and standard definitions of employment. Basically, in carrying out the provisions of the JEDPA Act, this Section 1 requires submission of the governor's coordination plan and all local service delivery job plans to the Legislative Assembly for review and comment 120 days before plans take effect. And the rest of that section deals with a Carl Perkins Vocational Education Act, and that report is already filed with the Job Training Coordinating Council. Section 2, the State Job Training Coordinating Council shall require the adoption of a statewide standard definition of entered employment for service delivery areas. This definition shall include a requirement all trainees remain on the job for a period of at least 1 month for at least 30 hours per week, and these trainees not meeting these requirements may be counted as entered employment if they are identified as experiencing specific barriers such as age or handicap or number of dependents. In the next amendment is to Senate Bill 271, and it is amended to delete what was previously written in the bill and require that each private industry council shall establish an advisory committee to assist in developing job training plans and overseeing services provided under the Federal JEDPA Act. And it requires this advisory committee to be composed of women, significant racial or ethnic groups, eligible program participants, and public assistance recipients from within the service delivery area. Senate Bill 272, the amendment, Section 1, specifies the reporting requirements on performance contracts. And Section 2 requires Section 2 on the next page. Oh, section we pulled out of 272 and put in Senate Bill 72. Senate Bill 273 requires that the Adult and Family Service Division not adopt rules limiting the length of time a recipient may be enrolled in a job training program sponsored or available under the JEPA Act. Nor shall the Adult and Family Service Division adopt any rule restricting or penalizing participation in the federal program by a recipient.
I wanted the committee members to understand what was in the packet. I think that there's a number of these that are very important. One of the issues that we dealt with in the interim, was the non-coordination between the Adult and Family Service programs and this particular program. I don't know if we had a fiscal analysis that was compared on this. We have done some independent work on that.
They do have a fiscal analysis that was passed out.
Okay. But I think, as I said, although there's been some effort by Adult and Family Service under the pressure of the interim committee to amend their practices, there has not been a change in some of their rules. I think that would reflect the kind of coordination that would allow welfare recipients to participate to the maximum they're allowed under the federal law. Did you have any more information with respect to that that you want to share?
If you want me to share the talking to the federal.
Yes, I would appreciate that.
Upon Senator Hendrickson's request, I spoke to someone who is in the Seattle Region 10 office of the Health and Human Service Division and asked, in regards to Senate Bill 273, whether or not federal law would allow Adult and Family Service Division to exempt work search requirements for clients receiving Job Training Partnership Act, and by doing so, would they be required to exempt all ADC clients from work search? The answer I received over the telephone was that no, federal law would not require AFS to exempt work search requirements for all ADC clients if the ADC clients who were receiving JEPA training were exempted. She indicated that when clients are placed in job training under JEPA, that the state has a lot of discretionary power to tailor a program that will meet the client's needs. In response to the assertion that exempting only JEPA clients would be a violation of equal protection, she indicated that this type of exemption would not violate equal protection law because of the assumption that when making a client job ready, only clients who can benefit from JEPA training would be placed in job training under this program. So all situations are not equal, and this recognition would allow AFS exemptions for clients who can benefit from job training under JEPA. I have requested that written confirmation of this conversation be sent to Senator Hendrickson.
The reason I asked for that, as you may remember, Keith Putnam was saying, we couldn't do it because if we allow them to do it, we would violate the Constitution, which I, the equal protection argument, which I never thought was too good an argument on his part anyway, but I decided to check it out with the federal government, which confirmed what I thought, that there was no equal protection issue, and that in fact the state does have the right to be able to tailor those programs and to allow, in other words, allow welfare participants who are in job training partnership different kind of regulations than those that are not in that program. And from all that we can find out, there's absolutely no reason why we can't do that. There's no federal problem or no constitutional problem in doing that. So I wanted the committee to have that information. As I said, we're also going to, we've checked, I think, or are checking with the Attorney General with respect to that issue as well. I think it's important because we are having, in parts of our state, people who should be in this program being prevented from being in the program by the Adult and Family Services and by their rules and regulations. This program is to help get people off the rolls and to reduce the welfare caseload. So I wanted you to have that information with respect to Senate Bill 273 and 269. Okay, is there any further committee discussion with respect to that? I'm going to also send a copy to each committee member of the National Alliance of Business material with respect to job-generating activities under this act. Okay, let's move on to coffee kitchen. Okay, we're going to move to the public hearing work session on Senate Bill 740.
I was in that interim.
Is she going to come up? We have one person who has signed to testify on Senate Bill 740. Bill Penhollow from Association of Oregon Counties.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. I apologize to the committee this morning that I do not have prepared testimony, nor someone here to present the committee with testimony on Senate Bill 740. I have talked with several counties, and each have raised concerns about this particular legislation. It's a piece of legislation that we did oppose in the last session. And I did want to take this opportunity to advise the committee that we do have some concerns. I continue to discuss this with county councils, hopefully get on record their concerns with the legislature, with the legislation. I do not have anyone here this morning, and I apologize for that, but I did want to make that information available to the committee.
Okay. Can you tell us what your concerns are?
I think, Madam Chair, that there is a statement prepared, that I was reading a statement prepared by the City Attorney's Office of the City of Portland this morning that I think expresses the concerns of most public officials or public attorneys with respect to 740. And I assume that you're going to be hearing that after myself.
Well, you're the only one signed up to testify at this point, unless there's other people out there.
Okay. But just very briefly, and not having the expertise to really present this argument, the concern is that if a contract is let to the apparent low bidder, and then there are conditions in the contract that he has not allowed for in his bid, comes back and secures additional compensation for that, and that is unfair to the other bidders on the contract who have taken into account those conditions and considerations and submitted their bid with the understanding that they would be assuming that risk. It's a matter, Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I understand it, of shifting responsibility for risk-taking for items that should be known to the contractor from the contractor back to the public agency.
Well, if there was a delay which was caused by the act or omission of the public contracting agency, would be where this provision would fit in. I'm just trying to figure out how.
I can't, Madam Chair.
Well, I'd like to ask him to respond to that if he could. Or I realize that you're not an attorney or a legal expert on this matter, but you're saying if in their bid they omitted something which caused a delay You're afraid that in that situation, that could lead to them invoking this part of the statute?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think that is the argument that is being offered by at least the county councils that I've talked with. I have nothing in writing, or I would submit it to the committee, because I really haven't been able to define what their concern is, other than I have had several of them say that it's a matter of concern and that's something that we should watch carefully.
Madam Chair.
All right, Senator Houck and then Senator Otto.
Yeah, Bill, you understand that this can only be invoked over unreasonable delays. How can you anticipate a reasonable delay? In other words, if it is put in the contract, something like the county will have the power lines moved by May 1st, and they aren't moved by May 1st, and the contractors are, equipment sits there for a month while the county's portion of the contract is not fulfilled, then this act applies. If you would put in the contract something like it is anticipated but not guaranteed that May 1st will move the power lines, and that tells the contractor a whole different thing and takes the county off the hook. The problem is that public agencies, because a contractor does not have the right or the ability to modify the bid in any way, other than it's a non-responsive bid in the public contractor, to say, I accept all the contracts, but I don't accept this liability. In the private sector, or even the private sector isn't in here, you can qualify your bids. And 99% of all the bids in the private sector, we do qualify our bids. In the public sector, you can't do it. So they write the contract, you anticipate that you're going to do what you say you're going to do, you don't do it, and our remedy is to give us an extension of time. That's our only remedy, because you write it in the contract. This is to prohibit that. Unreasonable delays is the key. You can't anticipate, by the definition of unreasonable delay, you can't anticipate a problem that's generated by yourself, or if you've left it out, errors or admissions. That's the problem.
Okay. Madam Chair,
I might say to you, Mr. Penhall, yes, that we have received written testimony in opposition to this bill from the City of Portland, which articulates the argument you're trying to present.
That's right.
Very well.
That's true.
Madam
Chair, if I just might comment to Senator Houck, I understand what he's saying, and I think he's making a very valid point. My question also would be, as if the public agency indicates in the contract that the contractor is responsible for scheduling the move or the relocation of those facilities, then it's the contractor's responsibility.
Yeah, you bet. They do that all the time. It's only in the area that they write a term or condition in the contract, or they leave it totally out. But it's to get around the contracts that say we're going to perform this, or another contractor is going to perform this function, and they don't get it done, and you're set there with the meter running while these delays happen. And then they say the only compensation we can give you during that month and a half you sat there is additional month and a half on the end of your contract. Well, 90% of all contracts are finished in 3/4 of the time. So, you may have 6-7 months left in your contract.
Madam Chair, Senator Houck, I will certainly pass those comments along to the people I'm talking with.
They've been passed on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify?
I had the
Senator Otto, I'm sorry.
I've been involved in one way or another with contracting for the last 33 years. What you have when you issue a public contract, one of the things that usually occurs is a pre-bid conference, where they get all the bidders together, and they discuss the job. And I'm sure that those pre-bid conferences produce a lot of good information, not only for the contractors bidding the job, but also for the one letting the job. I would be the first one to agree that you can't predict all of these things that may occur. Now, let me give you an example. Part of this light rail that's going out to Gresham is in my district. And I received numerous calls, and I met with TriMet officials and other people involved, and the public that was involved, and the business owners that was involved. And anyway, things were not going as per schedule. And one example was a flagpole located on a Burger King property. It was, I think, TriMet's responsibility to see that it was moved so construction could take place. Well, there was delay. And as a result, they were working around this flagpole. Now, that may not have been a big issue in a multi-million dollar contract, but it was just an example of delay. I also was told by different officials along the line that access and egress to the property would be completed at a certain period of time. It wasn't. And many of these property owners were very irate. And I think it was probably a combination of the public agency and the private contractor not coordinating the job properly. But it did cause a lot of trouble, expense, not only to the public agencies, but also to the private property owners. One other thing. The company I work for does quite a bit of school work. And we have had problems with a school district in the metropolitan area where we give them a bid, and then as a result, they don't follow through all the time on their commitment. And as a result, you go there to do the job, and it's not ready to do at the time it was prescribed to do that portion of the job. So as a result, you pick up your equipment and you go elsewhere. And then they start yelling and screaming, well, why aren't you here doing the job as outlined? And they were the ones who were responsible for that. So these are not normal times, believe me, in the construction industry. Contractors are hungry. But when contractors are well fed, like in the late 1970s and the 1980s, you know what the attitude is? Heck with them. We won't bid on their jobs. It just causes too much trouble and too much hardship on us as contractors. So they don't bid, these responsible contractors. Who pays the cost? It's the public out here, because they're getting a higher bid than they should be. And the public is the one who eventually pays when public agencies don't do their job. I'm not saying a blanket indictment of all public agencies. I think there's some very responsible public agencies out there. But there's some that try to cut corners and don't provide complete plans, complete specifications. They don't do what a contracting group should do. And the one who suffers is the taxpaying public, either through higher bids or, many times, no bids.
I might say, Senator, the public is going to pay under this bill as well, because there will be increased litigation. There's no question about it. That is the whole purpose, is to give them a cause of right to go into court and litigate. It's simply, to me, a question of who is going to assume the risk for delay. The law now shifts that risk onto the contractor and assumes that the contractor is going to, or at least an experienced contractor, is going to put that in their bid with respect to that shift.
Madam Chair, in
if I could complete my statement, Senator Otto. So when, I don't think we want to get a little too righteous about talking about we're going to save taxpayers' dollar on this bill. We are not. We don't have a legislative fiscal impact on local government. I understand this bill. And certainly we can shift and allow the public body, whether it's a school board or a city or a county, to assume the risk if there's a delay and to pay out the money, because there will be more settlements in favor of contractors. There will be more litigation because right now they're barred from litigation. This is to permit them to litigate. So this will provide more attorney fees for contractors, lawyers. This will provide more expenditures of public dollars for municipal attorneys, school board attorneys, county councils. And so I have no illusions about the fact it's going to cost the public more money. That may be what the legislature wants. I know that's what the majority of this committee wants, this bill. But at least let's not kid ourselves about it. I mean, it is going to increase the cost on public bodies.
Madam Chair.
Senator Otto.
I think we, in rebuttal to your argument, when any contractor goes to court, that contractor is also suffering, and the public body may well suffer. I look at this bill as an opportunity for public contracting agencies to be more responsible in bid and specification preparation. Hopefully, there won't be any lawsuits over that. And I think that this bill will provide more responsible responsible bids being submitted for public.
Well, I think if you probably would look.
Go ahead and make public agencies aware of the fact that rather than using many times their own personnel to prepare bids, that they will start seeking expertise in the preparation of bids, bid documents, and the specifications and the prints.
Well, I think if you look at the state of Washington, California, where they have this law, would be interesting to look. I would be willing to wager that there's litigation. I think you could have the most experienced people on both sides developing contracts and people developing bid specifications, and there's going to be a situation which there's a delay. It's just a cost shifting mechanism here, and we just have to make a decision on those kind of cases, we're going to shift the risk. This bill shifts it to the public entity. And, you know, that is a public policy decision, if that's what the will of this committee is or the will of the body is, that's what will happen. But at least I think we need to understand what we're doing. And I think you just simply can't say when you're opening, you're creating a cause of action on a contract, right, that you're not going to have litigation, you know.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
You may, on the interpretation, what the design is designed for one specific task, and that's to force owners of a contract, public entities, to say what they want done or to say what they're going to do. Now, that's all that the bill does. It doesn't, words like are used by many public agencies, it's anticipated but not guaranteed is a phrase they use. That takes them off the hook from the liability. What it does when they use that phrase, it adds to the contract price. They know.
That's right.
Well, if they would say it's anticipated but not guaranteed that this is going to happen, a red flag goes up with a contract and say, I might have a delay. So he puts a contingency in his bid. Okay, but they don't say it. They say, we'll have the telephone poles moved by May 1. So a contractor reads the contract and says, well, okay, by May 1, that's a term and condition they'll put in the contract. So they say, we won't put a contingency in the bid. They're going to have their they're going to do what they said they're going to do. And they don't do it. And they say, that's fine, we'll just give you a few days at the end of the contract. They're willing to face up with the commitment that they made contractual. And the remedy under their contract, because we can't alter the bid, is to say, we'll give you a few days at the end of the contract because we delayed you. We won't compensate you for your loss because we didn't do what we said unreasonably. And that's the shift that you're talking about, is the shift is trying to make a public agency do what it has contractually said it was going to do.
Madam Chair?
Just a second, Senator McCoy.
I would suggest that before we have a work session next time on this bill, that we put in both private and public, private contractors as well as public contractors. That's all I want to.
Okay.
Madam Chair, two different issues totally.
I think, though, Senator Houck, in response to your arguments, experienced contractors, I'm sure, if they're dealing with
no limit under the Holeen case.
Okay, any questions for witness?
Thank you.
Oh, did you have a question?
No, just a question, the chairman.
Senator McCoy.
Has there been a case where there's been unlimited?
Holeen has not gone back to the trial court to be retried yet, so I don't, that I know of anyway, so I don't know
what
the result is.
So what you're doing is speculating that it would be unreasonable.
Yes, I am speculating of that potential, and just the fact that the potential is there is what causes many claims now, I think, is going to, I mean, I've got a case right in my office that I'm defending right now that we feel that we could have defended, but because of that possibility that if we lose, we're going to be subjected to punitive damages of an unlimited amount, we are now in the process of trying to settle.
Most of these cases would be jury cases, wouldn't they?
Well, most people, yes, they, yes. Well, right now they're not. But under the wrongful discharge claim, which the Supreme Court has now created, yes, that is a jury case.
Let me just, for the benefit of the committee members, you're an attorney. When are punitive damages awarded?
Well, they're awarded, the guideline is for conduct that is beyond the limits of societal tolerances and obligations. So by creating, basically the Supreme Court is saying that a discriminatory firing amounts to that kind of a claim. But and not every discriminatory firing, that would be handled in...
It has to be pretty outrageous conduct, doesn't it?
Well, there's a standard jury instruction. It doesn't define it in terms of...
I'm not talking about standard. I'm talking about for lay people to understand that you don't, in every case, get punitive damages.
Right. I think that's correct.
The defendant has to act in a willful manner that shows total disrespect for societal norms,
obligations.
Isn't that correct?
Yes.
So, when you're saying that an employer you're representing is facing punitive damages, are there facts in that case that could suggest that behavior was present in your defendant?
Not in my case, there aren't. But we always have that possibility. What is the juror going to do?
Well, I guess there's a possibility of anything in the world happening. Mm-hmm. You know, the world could end tomorrow. But I mean, basically, when you I just want the committee to understand.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Does this have a referral to judiciary?
It does have a subsequent referral.
Does it have? Mm-hmm. To what?
To judiciary.
Well, it seems like a, you know, a real policy question that should be argued
right.
out.
Right, well, I think that's why it's got two committees, because it's got labor implications, uh-huh. and it's got judiciary implications.
Will you have a fiscal impact statement on this?
No.
What do you mean? It's got fiscal impact. States certainly liable.
It doesn't have.
What do you mean?
In terms of state liability?
Yeah.
That's a good point.
They're subject to it.
However, this is not going to be floor. This is going to a subsequent committee.
Well,
Mr. Robert, I hope I can pronounce this right.
Udzila.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, my name is Robert Udzila, and I, too, am an attorney in private practice in Portland with the law firm of Posey Wilson, Atchison, and Lilly and Conboy, and I am here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 495. I would join in the comments of the representative from the Department of Labor, just as perhaps some rebuttal to some of the things that were said earlier. I would disagree with the person who just testified before you regarding the fact that state and federal laws in the employment area are purely equitable in terms of the kinds of relief that can be awarded to people who are the object of discrimination. Sections 411 and 412 of the National Labor Relations Act permit compensatory damages and permit jury trials. Section 301 of the National Labor Relations Act, again in the employment setting, permits compensatory damages and permits jury trials. The Equal Pay Act under the federal law permits not only compensatory damages, but liquidated damages or double damages, and also permits a jury trial. I'm unsure whether Section 504 of the Rehab Act of the Federal Congress permits a jury trial, but I believe that it does. And certainly 1983 claims under the Civil Rights Act, which arise in employment situations, permit not only jury trials and compensatory damages, but in certain cases, punitive damages. So we are not carving out some kind of special state law that is contrary to what is going on in the rest of the country by permitting jury trials in this kind of case. Actually, one of the reasons that we support this particular bill, members of the committee, we represent mentally and physically handicapped people. And what we see this bill as a clarification of the current law and making a uniformity in the current law in the method by which Oregon's strong policy against discrimination, particularly in the workplace, is enforced. As it stands now, I would disagree again with the person who just testified previously. I think there is great confusion in the court system. I think that there is confusion across the courts and the different circuit courts in the state of Oregon as to what kinds of remedies are available. The Holian case stands for the proposition that there are several potential remedies that someone discriminated against may obtain benefits in the court, but I'm not certain that all the courts understand precisely what it is that is available to someone discriminated against. I will give you an example. In the Oregon Appellate Reports, Volume 48, as I cited in the memo, there is the case of Windsor versus Independent Paper Stock decided by the Court of Appeals. I happen to know that case because it was my case, and the Court of Appeals says that under Chapter 659, you do not get a jury trial. In that same volume of appellate reporters is the case of Carney versus Guard Publishing Company, wherein a jury trial was allowed in the circuit court in Lane County, I believe it was. Although the case was reversed, it was not reversed on that issue. The only issue before the appellate court in that case was what was substantial employment.
Are people arguing that because of the merger in Law and Equity, you could get a
Madam Chair, we're arguing that they're not getting very far. That argument is not selling in terms of the circuit courts, at least in our experience. Rather, what has happened now is that because of Holian, and I do not believe that this is advancing Oregon at the forefront of anti-discrimination laws, the court in Holian pointed out earlier decisions that it had, this Supreme Court, the Oregon Supreme Court, had made, indicating that there are specific common law remedies in the employment discharge field. As I pointed out on page 2 of my memo, a discharge for assertion of a right to attend jury duty. That was decided in 1975, 10 years ago. A discharge for exercising the right to resist sexual advances. That's the Holian case, decided in 1984. A discharge for filing a workers' compensation case. That's Brown versus Transcom, decided in 1978. And a discharge for a refusal to sign a false and defamatory statement, Delaney versus Taco Time, which was decided in 1984. So Holian did not surprise a lot of people who had been looking at how the cases were going in employment discrimination.
So you're saying, are you saying that the Holian case was really just wasn't a complete turnabout or something?
It's
simply
an
evolution in terms of these other cases?
I think that's right, and I think because of the confusion that is reigning in courts as to precisely what benefits are people who are discriminated against entitled to in court, that is why this bill is so good. Everybody is entitled to a jury trial, whether they're discriminated against because of employment or because they're handicapped or because of real estate problems, whatever. Everybody's entitled to a jury trial. I don't know how anybody can oppose a jury trial to have one's case decided by a jury of one's peers. Oregon Constitution permits a jury trial in almost all cases. The Chapter 659 granting equitable relief only has been an exception to that carved out by the legislature. Because of the continued response of discrimination in the workplace, I think the courts are starting to say we're going to need to make exceptions to that statutory exception. And it seems to me that the legislature can do it very easily by just simply saying, in these kinds of cases, we're entitled to a jury trial. One final point, and then I'll quit. As to ex-employee or punitive damages, that really isn't a large concern from our client's standpoint. Compensatory damages is important, particularly in the injured worker setting, because reinstatement is not really a right. You can talk about giving somebody 2 months of back wages and then putting them right back on the job where they've been discriminated against, and you've got yourself a problem. What you need are the kinds of damages that Madam Chairperson was talking about for the kind of humiliation that takes place, be it sexual harassment, be it harassment for asserting your right to file a workers' comp claim, which everyone in the state has. That's the kind of damages that simply cannot be remedied by putting that person right back in that same work environment and giving them a couple of months of back pay. I will say that there are other people who would be witnesses in favor of this bill who represent the handicapped, both mentally and physically, who are unable to be here today, but if this bill is again before committee, will be here to testify in favor of it.
Okay, thank you. I also appreciate your citations and previous witnesses' ones on the legal issues. Any questions for this witness? Okay, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 495, and we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 408. What I'd like is I've had a request from the Senate Education Committee to have this bill before it. We had an issue up in education on Senate Bill 682, and Senator Day proposed some amendments to that bill, which was essentially your bill, Senator Houck. I don't know if he did this. And what I said at the time to the committee is that we had this bill in the Senate. It was referred to Senate Labor, but it really is a matter that the Education Committee has been dealing with. So the chair would like to move that we send this to the President's desk and ask for a re-referral to the Senate Education Committee.
I'll move.
Is that one where we need a roll call vote, or can I just ask to
roll call?
Okay.
Roll.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Howe?
Aye.
Senator Dernstein?
Aye.
Senator McCaul?
Aye.
Senator Otto?
Aye.
Senator Starkovich? Senator Hendrickson?
Aye. Okay, that'll be so ordered. Okay, I think that concludes our business for the day, unless there's anything the committee members want to do. Are we scheduled next Tuesday? Yeah, we're 10 o'clock on.
We're not going to have our night meeting tonight, Mark.
No, we could meet every night. We're beginning to feel like we are. Next Tuesday, we're going to try to keep our agenda moving. If we get a lot of work done Monday and Friday, we'll cancel the Tuesday meeting. I want, if you could keep your schedules clear. Also, I want to tell you, we are going to be taking up the Compel Worth bill Friday. Hopefully we can take some action on it. We've also scheduled time Monday. That's the subcommittee we've heard.
You're not going to say you're going to take action on Friday.
I'm hoping to. Because it's not going to the floor, it's going to the Ways and Means Committee.
No. Give me a chance to hit my feet on the ground.
Well, you've got...